Welcome to The Blast Zone, the podcast where we dig up the bombs that shook Hollywood and try to find out why they went up in flames. This week, they say the best things in life are free. Let's hope it's true about the State of Jones. This is Free State of Jones. Welcome, welcome, welcome to The Blast Zone.
Welcome to The Blast Zone.
We are not a podcast about bad movies. We are a podcast about movies that did badly.
That's right.
I am John Drake, in-house film critic of my Letterboxd account.
And I'm Ian Dukes. I'm a person with thoughts and feelings, and some of them are about movies.
Movies like Free State of Jones, which we'll be talking about today. But before we get into that, Ian, how are you doing this week?
You know what? The warm weather is finally here. I opened all my windows this week, and I can hear my neighbors, and now I really miss winter.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Warm weather is nice, but I remembered that sweat is a thing that I do, and I don't know.
I feel like we're kind of skipping spring in the Northeast here. We had like a week in February where it was like 70 degrees, and then this week it's starting to get nice again, but there's usually like a few weeks where the weather's okay, but there's not like a ton of bugs and stuff yet, and like we just went right to all the bugs.
So, oh, no.
Yeah, I feel like the seasons are kind of shifting. Spring starting later. Like everything's starting later. We might have to redefine these seasons in the future due to climate change.
Might have to draw up a new map of the seasons.
Feels like the old model's getting a little outdated. Everything's not happening when it's supposed to.
That seems harmless though, right?
Can't have any kind of cascading consequences.
Changing the basic definitions of winter, summer, day, night, good, bad. Those are just things that naturally evolve, I assume.
Right. But with the weather being nice and all, I assume you didn't get to stay inside and watch anything this week, did you?
Actually, yeah. I watched a few things, but the thing that I wanted to talk about is the new show Fallout, which is brand new. It's on Amazon Prime. I went into the show like I knew what it was about, but I went in never having played a Fallout game. So I figured, let me bring this to show and tell as a guy who lacks all expectations, except for the ones that I bring in as a fan in general of post-apocalyptic sci-fi. And the short of it is, I liked it. I don't think that you need to love Fallout or even know much about Fallout to get into this show. It's a well-constructed show. The really good thing that I noticed about it is the writers seem to be operating on what you would think might be a pretty basic storytelling premise. They're going on the idea that things should happen in a story. As we know, so much of TV writing these days, it's like they set up a premise and they're like, isn't that a cool premise? And they make you wait and wait for the characters to make any progress towards the big thing that they dropped on you.
Looking at you, Silo.
Yeah.
Good comparison to make with Fallout because they share an aesthetic post-apocalypse, but Silo's deadly serious compared to...
Yeah, post-apocalyptic vaults are definitely a theme there. But Silo, I know that in that case, the book was written that way. There's a lot of leading up to what happens when you go outside the door. There's people going through vault doors pretty early on in this, and a lot of other things happen. Circumstances keep changing. You go, oh, the antagonist is going to meet the protagonist at some point, and then they just crash them together in the second episode or whatever. Like, all these things just keep happening. It's really satisfying in that basic way that the story moves, and it keeps you interested and doesn't make you feel bogged down. I'm really enjoying the show.
Yeah, I am a player of the Fallout games. Not a huge fan by any means, but I played Fallout 3. I played New Vegas. I dipped my toes into Fallout 4. But I'm really excited to watch the show. The reviews it's getting are very encouraging, and it has a pretty big justified crossover. Everyone's favorite coal miner slash thief with a heart of coal, Boyd Crowder. Walton Goggins himself has a pretty beefy role in the Fallout series, yeah. Does he not? Is he the main character? Ella Purnell, I guess, would be like the protagonist, right?
Yeah, his bad guy, so to speak, is pretty central to the story, too. So it's great. He's a delight. She's really good.
I also like Ella Purnell quite a bit. She was on Yellow Jackets and really good part on there.
She's a great fit for this. The third lead is a guy named Aaron Moten, who I don't know. Like, he hasn't been in that much stuff, but he's not a kid. He's like 35, but this is kind of his breakout thing. At least that's what people are saying.
He's a young pup, all right? 35 is, his life's just getting started.
He's really interesting in this. Really good casting because he doesn't quite fit any of the molds that you think an actor in this role would fit, but yet he's perfect in my opinion. Really good.
Yeah, going through the cast now. Johnny Pemberton. I love Johnny Pemberton. Zach Cherry. They've got a lot of like really funny comedic actors in this. But then I know the show can get pretty dark from what I've heard. I'm definitely going to take some time this weekend and at least get through the first couple episodes.
I think you'll dig it.
I was prepared to come and speak about a show as well at Show and Tell. I had just started the new Hulu series Under the Bridge, which is very much in my wheelhouse of female detectives investigating crimes and a town with a dark past. Very Sharp Objects-y. Riley Keough plays a journalist who comes home home, whatever. I'm not talking about that because I just fucking opened up Shudder this morning and saw that Late Night with the Devil was streaming finally.
Oh.
And I was raring to turn it on. So I watched Late Night with the Devil in the middle of the day, the way it's probably meant to.
Safer, I think.
And man, it's a ride. Really, really liked
really?
It. I highly recommend it. David Desmalchian, who plays the late night host of a kind of struggling late night show who's trying to boost his ratings, decides to bring on some occult guests for a Halloween special.
Oh.
And that's all I'm going to say. I think the less you know.
I was going to say, we know about Halloween specials and occult guests.
It's true. We have Nash on sometimes. She's an occult guest. And we do Blastober. So we're very much podcasting with the devil occasionally.
Thankfully, nothing like that has ever happened to us. What I assume happens in this movie, which is something horrifying.
You don't know. Okay. It could just be a show that goes well and everyone goes home at the end.
Comedy hijinks ensue.
It's a variety show. So a variety of things happen to a variety of people. That's all I'll say.
Okay. But
definitely recommend it. All AI controversy aside, I don't know if you saw that some of the title cards for the show itself were AI generated. The filmmakers have come out in defense of it. Not defense of it, but just said we used AI as a starting point, but then we had real artists actually finish the work on it, which I'm not a fan of AI usage in art in general, but it's not going away anytime soon. So we have to find a way to coexist with it. And that seems to be it. As long as real artists and real craftsmen are still getting work, that seems like the happiest medium that can be achieved.
It's not the worst stumble. It's definitely useful that that became a discussion point because all of Hollywood needs to see and engage in that discussion and figure out what are the right ways to apply these technologies that don't deprive artists of their livelihood and that are maybe constructive.
Not to go off on too much of a tangent, but I don't know if you saw the controversy around the Civil War posters, which seemed to be almost entirely AI generated with like buildings in the wrong spots or just not looking correct.
I saw it start to pop up, but I didn't know if the accusations were genuine or what had really happened.
No, they're genuine. I'm sure Alex Garland, who is well familiar with the dangers of AI, if you watched Ex Machina,
kind of about that,
did not encourage the studio to do it. But an interesting argument I saw is if you hired an artist to make these posters and they just put two of the most recognizable buildings in Chicago in the wrong fucking place in the skyline, you'd either make them redo it or you'd fire them. Like, why are we pretending that it's okay when AI does it, though? You know, like,
can't you make AI fix its mistakes? Or is it the problem that there's nobody who knows better, like no actually one's, operating the AI?
I think that's the problem. No one's checking. Unchecked AI has never been a problem in any sci-fi story I've seen. I do want to see Civil War, but it did put a damper on it for me.
Yeah, there's all kinds of dampers on movies. Our movie today has its own share of little dampers, but I think we got through it and have some positive things to say about it.
Yeah, Free State of Jones. I remember when this movie came out, seeing the trailers and everything and thinking like, huh, it definitely looks like a movie that Matthew McConaughey would be in. And that was the last I thought of it for many years. But I started hearing from people, hey, that Free State of Jones movie was a bomb and that was pretty good. You guys should talk about it, including somebody we may hear from later. And a friend of mine, Tim, is from Laurel, Mississippi, or Hattiesburg, one of those towns. And he took an interest in this story. Obviously, I think if you're from rural Mississippi, you know at least a baseline of information about Newton Knight and the Free State of Jones and all that. But he asked if we could cover the movie, and I said, yeah, why not?
It's definitely a movie worth covering.
What did you know about this movie before we sat down to watch it for this pod?
You know what I was trying to think? I think this movie totally missed me. I can't recall if I was aware of it at all. If you got me to try to name a list of McConaughey movies from the last 10, 20 years, this one might have never made it.
We'd have a lot of podcasting to do if we tried to name it, because that motherfucker's been in some bombs.
Yeah.
White Boy Rick, coming soon. But The Free State of Jones is kind of an interesting story. Gary Ross, who was trying to get this movie made for a long time, he kept flopping. But then he made The Hunger Games and he stopped flopping and he decided to use his newfound power in Hollywood to get this movie made. And then there he was like, I still couldn't get it made. It just goes to show. $50 million is a big budget for a movie like this, I think. They don't typically do gangbusters at the box office.
This is a historical drama. I was even calling it edudrama. Like, it has that feeling. Yes, it's dramatic and it's fun for people who want to see just pure, serious, old-timey stuff on screen. But it's also trying to teach you about history, which is fine. I think that's an okay goal for a movie, but I don't think it lights people's pants on fire to run down to the theater.
No, and even the movie is leisurely paced, or at least very deliberately paced. It's not at a breakneck speed. It takes its time. The set pieces are few and far between, and then we'll get into it eventually, but there's one whole separate subplot that just stops the movie dead in its tracks every time it rears its head.
Yeah, I would say the movie starts out as one thing and then just starts to morph over the course of the movie, and you have to rethink about what are you watching, because in my experience on the first watch when I put this on, I was pretty engrossed by the plot and the drama. It felt like it was unfolding pretty quickly, and the drama was heightening to the extent where I didn't even pause the movie to make a single note, because I'm like, oh no, I'm too into this. I don't want to break the flow. I'm just going to watch the movie. So I'm like, this is a good good adventure story. And then the movie goes on and the pace slows down. You could say it gets bogged down in a swamp a little bit. Hey-o. And then you realize the whole movie, which started as this classical adventure, is fighting with itself like, oh, now it's time. We got to call the class to order, get all the kids to sit down, and we got to start teaching history lessons. And so it loses some momentum, not in like a offensive way, but it's noticeable where you go, what is this movie doing? The years are passing. I thought we were going to like see an episode in this part of history. And like, no, it's still going. The clock is not stopping.
I commend Gary Ross for fighting to tell this story, but he wanted to make a movie about the Reconstruction South.
Yeah.
And he found his lens to tell it through Newton Knight. But that's two movies. If you want to do justice for both those stories, I think it's two movies.
Yeah. Especially just the way you say that. I read that same thing. Like, he was motivated by telling the story of Reconstruction and how it failed. And okay, so you're making that movie. The Civil War in your movie doesn't end till the 1 hour, 40 minute mark. Like, you can't talk about Reconstruction until you get over the entire movie length preamble, which was a good movie. But now it really starts to feel like two different movies.
It's got a little Return of the King problem. Keeps ending.
yeah, that's true.
I refuse also to call him Newt Knight because that's a rural juror ass name. That's a real Newt Knight, fucking...
Newt. I don't think anybody says Newt Knight, but they do call him Newt. After the first couple times where they've established that his name is Newton, it's like, Newt, hey, Newt.
Hey, Newt Knight sounds like something like a family whose house you sleep over at. That's how they say goodnight because they're weird. Like, people always call like their grandma something weird. Like, Newt Knight.
That's right.
That's what it feels like to me. Like, it was just rude of him to be named that. I think he should have changed his name so podcasters 100 something years in the future wouldn't have trouble.
I keep being tempted to call him Newt Jones because, like, oh, it's the Free State of Jones and Matthew McConaughey's face on the poster. I'm like, that's Jones. That's where I lean over to my date in the theater and whisper, that's the Jones.
I don't think it would have helped the white savior criticisms if he was like, we're making a new country and we're naming it after me.
You know what? I just read a little historical footnote that the original group was actually called the Knight Company.
Yeah, the Knight Company was like, they were like the guerrillas that did the fighting and like the waylaying of the Confederate supply lines.
So that was named after him. And Gary Ross was smart enough to be like, let's not put that in the title. Let's focus on the land that they're all tied to.
Yeah, I think Gary Ross was aware and sensitive to the white savior problem with this movie. But there's just no way to tell this story without indulging in it a little bit.
I think you're exactly right. There are hallmarks that he's being careful. He's tiptoeing around it. He's making gestures towards diffusing that. But you can't change the fact that Newton Knight is centered in this story.
Please call him Newton for the last time.
Didn't I say Newton Knight?
I thought you said Newt Knight.
You can't tell when I say it quick.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, you're trying to tell a story about the Civil War, about slavery and Reconstruction, and it's centered on a white guy. You can't escape that criticism. And sure, this guy was like a historical figure and his story is interesting to hear. So it's real. So it's not like you're making up a white savior to take credit away from people of color, but
it's not The Last Samurai.
No, but it's a choice and it's a choice that gets its fair share of criticism.
And rightfully so. But that being said, I think we both mostly like this movie. So do you want to get into it and we can start talking about the making of it?
All right. Let's hear how this thing happened.
All right. Gary Ross started his career as a writer, penning feel-good fare like Big, Mr. Baseball, and Lassie. He'd explore the darkness under seemingly perfect suburbia with his directorial debut, 1998's Tobey Maguire flop Pleasantville, which he also wrote. He would then write and direct his most critically successful film in 2003, the horse racing drama Seabiscuit, which would end up being nominated for 7 Oscars, including Best Picture. Unfortunately for Ross, a little movie called Return of the King also came out that year, and Seabiscuit came up empty-handed.
Empty-hoofed.
He'd find his biggest commercial success after writing and directing 2012's young adult battle royale fantasy drama The Hunger Games, which made nearly $700 million worldwide on a $78 million budget. The studio reportedly wanted Ross to return and direct the sequel Catching Fire, but Ross had a passion project he finally had the cachet to get made, a Civil War era drama about a group of runaway slaves and Confederate defectors called the Free State of Jones. Ross was inspired to make the film due to a desire to examine the Reconstruction era South, a time period he felt was underrepresented in film.
And overrepresented in Congress.
He'd been trying to get the film made for close to a decade, and now he finally had the means. Ross did a ton of research, dedicating years to reading about the era and the mythology surrounding the offense depicted in the film before starting to write the screenplay. He would center his script around Newton Knight, a controversial figure in the South who led the Knight Company, the aforementioned group of Civil War deserters who resisted and apparently partook in guerrilla warfare tactics against the Confederacy.
As one does.
Knight had been depicted on film before, in 1948's Taproots, but Ross wanted to retell the story for a contemporary audience. With a sizable $50 million budget secured, though some sources reported as high as $65 million, Ross announced that Matthew McConaughey would portray Knight in August of 2014.
You know, it would be more accurate if you portrayed him in 1865.
The rest of the cast was announced in early 2015, and shooting would start on February 23rd, 2015, in and around New Orleans. Filming wrapped on May 28th of that same year, and the film was scheduled for release on March 11th, 2016. The release date would be pushed back to May 13th and again to June 24th, putting the film firmly in summer blockbuster territory, going head-to-head with previous episode, Independence Day Resurgence.
Yeah, they bonked their heads together like the Three Stooges.
Alas, it was not meant to be, as the movie got mediocre reviews, currently sitting at 47% on Rotten Tomatoes, and flopped big time at the box office, opening in sixth place with just $7.6 million. Much of the criticism of the film centered on Knight being positioned as a white savior, a trope that had thankfully become less common by this point. The film has amassed a significant cult following in the years since. Yeah, is this the first time we've covered two movies released on the same day?
I think we've had them close before, but I don't remember them ever actually colliding. Do you think they hurt each other, or is there not really such a Independence Day overlap?
I don't think anyone that wants to go see Independence Day 2 was fiending to go see Free State of Jones on opening weekend. Yeah. They fulfill very different spectrums of the film-going populace, I would gather.
Yeah, and Independence Day is still like a holdover from a stronger point in the movie industry where summer blockbusters based on their own IP were like a real thing at a time when you could make original IP historical dramas and they were like mainstream. They were like monoculture kind of things. Free State of Jones, at least today, I don't know how that was 8 years ago, but it feels like that's streamer fodder, that's cable fodder. Like it's moved out of theaters. It's the kind of movie that no one wants to make anymore. And I guess they didn't really want to make it at that time already.
I think if this gets made today, it's debuting on Max or something similar. It definitely feels like an above average streaming movie today. You know, I miss going to see those in theaters. I saw a lot of movies in theaters that would be streamers today. I miss going to a mostly empty theater to watch Johnny Mnemonic or whatever.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
We've talked about, and we will talk about, the leisurely pace and the just how much content they stuffed in here. This would be a no-brainer to convert to a limited series where you could like actually do chapters for each of those points in history and get all his, I mean, he did years of research and the guy was serious about it. So it's not like a frivolous attempt at putting this stuff on film, but yeah, he probably left a lot of pages on the floor.
Yeah. And there's even a few subplots in the movie that we discussed feeling like they were missing scenes just because they go away for hours and then pop back up and they're not as fully fleshed out as they could be. And we'll get into more specifics around that. But I understand, not, why am I pretending like I don't know? My friend Matt is a big film buff. I tend to give him a lot of credit when he likes a movie. It carries some weight. Not when he likes nachos, because he attends my nacho crawls and he always has the worst choices for the best nachos. Starting to become a problem. But, you know, he's very much a film buff. So he was like, The Free State of Jones is actually a good movie. It would be cool if you guys covered it. And we were looking to spice up the podcast with a new segment anyway.
We always are.
So we were like, why don't you record a little review of the movie for us? Give us your thoughts on it, and then we can use that as like a jumping off point for some discussion. So without further ado, this is the guest corner, the guest zone, the blasty,
here we go.
Blasty corner, the blast minute.
Whatever this is, you're about to hear.
The guest zone.
Welcome to the guest zone. I'm Matt. Here to share my thoughts on Free State of Jones. Free State of Jones is more or less an amalgamation of most of Ed Zwick's white guilt movies. So you take the setting of Glory, the buddy relationship in Blood Diamond, the white savior meet cute of The Last Samurai, and the guerrilla forest action of Defiance. Put them all together, throw in some fun Southern accents, and boom, Free State of Jones. You also can throw in some of the first act of The Patriot with Mel Gibson's rustic man about town, doesn't want to get involved in the conflict, but oh no, he has some sort of personal incident. His personal grievance becomes a movement and he picks up followers, yada, yada. So that's more or less Free State of Jones. The first two thirds is going to be rolling your eyes, nothing you haven't seen before. Then the Civil War ends. You think movie's over. The Confederacy is defeated. Equality prevails. Yay, Lincoln. No, here's where Gary Ross throws a curveball, makes the whole movie worthwhile. The film continues on for another 40 minutes to quash any good feeling you have. We get a period of about 80 years of failure of Reconstruction, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, with a capstone highlighting Mississippi's miscegenation laws. So why'd I jump to the third act? Because the first two acts are derivative and boring. And the third act, you know what? You walk away going, good for Gary Ross. Not the most inventive filmmaker, nothing flashy, nothing out of the box. But as a screenwriter, tacks that third act on there, makes you think, all right, he gets it. There is no easy answer here. The end of the Civil War didn't really solve racism in America. Country's working on that. But there you go. Free State of Jones.
Thank you, Matt, for that.
Interesting.
Interesting takes. I think he's going in a different direction than you and I are. I was starting off like, yeah, this is a fun, rollicking action adventure in the first half or two thirds. And we're like, oh, now it's lecture time in Act Three. And Matt's like, hell yeah, lecture time, and digging into his popcorn.
So I have some major problems with the third act of this movie, but I do agree with him. It is an interesting storytelling device to bring us down from the euphoria of like the war is over, everyone's free, to rub our faces in the realism of how, you know, these things really happened. A lot of war movies don't concern themselves with the aftermath enough. And the Civil War especially had very far-reaching consequences we're still feeling to this day, like Matt said. That I do like. But yeah, the last act of this movie is a real bummer too.
I feel like it would be a good bummer. I would have wanted more of the stuff that happens in that part with the Moses character played by Mahershala Ali. That's really interesting. He's going around registering freedmen to vote. And you're like, wow, this is a piece of American history that I haven't seen on screen. But it's weirdly almost a footnote to the story. It's this long extended footnotes final chapter.
Yeah, I turned it off when he was doing that. Everyone was on board, right? They were all like,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, it was super cool. Worked out great.
Do your thing. No one minds. Do you want to start walking through the story so we can address some of these concerns a little more specifically?
Yeah, here we go. Newton Knight, played by Matthew McConaughey, is serving as a Confederate medic in the Civil War. He's already unhappy, knowing that rich Southern men are allowed to avoid service, while poor farmers like himself are forced to fight and die. When he runs into his terrified young nephew Daniel and finds out the boy was conscripted, well, that's the last straw. Newt deserts the army in order to bring the boy home, but the kid is shot and killed on the way. He tearfully returns the boy's body to his mother and then reunites with his wife, Serena, played by Kerry Russell, on their farm back in Jones County, Mississippi. When their infant son gets a fever, Newt befriends an enslaved woman named Rachel, played by Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who helps heal the boy. Newt decides to continue fighting injustice when he arms a local woman and her children. Together, they chase off Confederate Cavalry Lieutenant Barber and his troops when they come to seize the women's pigs to feed the army. Now, Newt is really in trouble. He's pursued by a search party with dogs, and to avoid capture, he's forced to flee into the swamp.
I just want to call out Cavalry Lieutenant Barber as just like a hilarious dandy. Are you still allowed to say dandy?
I hope so.
He's always like wearing a cape. He's got this fancy little head. He's my dear madam, we need this cloth.
He's got those cavalry gloves, those big deerskin gloves with the outrageous wrist that flares out fancifully. Yeah, he's real old timey. But they're also, to this movie's credit, the historical stuff, the costuming is really good. So his costume is like outlandish, but it's also fucked up because he's the like backwater lieutenant, right? The people who didn't actually go to fight on the front lines. He's got a shitty job because he's probably a shitty dude. And his stuff is like fancy, but like, you better not look at it too close.
Right. Yeah. Like there's no substance to my critique of his garb and speech. I just find him hilarious. He talks like Foghorn Leghorn and he's dressed like the fucking sheriff of Nottingham.
Yeah. He makes a fun villain and the actor is well cast for it.
Yeah. He's definitely a guy I recognize, but I wouldn't know his name.
His name's Bill Tangrady and don't tell John, but he was on season 5 of Justified.
I've definitely seen him and stuff. Same with the Colonel.
Yeah. There's a bunch of that guys in this movie. And I apologize that we didn't pull all their names out. Two of Newton's best friends who he fights in the war with and then later join up with the Free State guys are also like absolutely that guy kind of character actors.
Yeah, I had to look up one of them, the guy who plays Will.
The guy from Deadwood?
Yeah, I was like, I know that guy. So I had to look him up.
And yeah.
Yeah, that is Sean Bridgers. Good actor.
Okay, that's Al Swearengen's not right-hand man, but second to right-hand man, who kind of just gets clean up that blood kind of jobs.
Yeah, and he looks like Garrett Dillahunt's less attractive younger brother kind of.
What an insult. That's like a very inside Hollywood way to tear a guy down.
But Garrett Dillahunt is like super handsome. So you think about it that way.
Sometimes
it really is.
Played a handsome man and a hideous man on that same show, Deadwood, on different seasons.
True. But he was a very handsome man in Justified, which, speaking of Justified, we get a big crossover. We haven't had one in a while.
Yeah. I thought it was a different kind of crossover. I was like, it's a Mud crossover. If anybody has seen Matthew McConaughey in Mud from 2012.
That's not a segment. We don't have a soundbite for that.
No.
But Jacob Laughlin was in Mud as, was it Neckbone? Bone was his name?
I think he was Neckbone, yeah.
If there is a character named Neckbone, it was definitely him. I just couldn't remember. I was like, is it Collarbone? Clavicle? What was his kid's fucking name? But yeah, he played Neckbone in Mud with McConaughey. That was actually his first role.
Oh, okay.
And then in between Mud and Free State of Jones, he played Kendall Crowe on season 5, the much maligned season 5 of Justified, a member of the Crowe clan who suck, and Michael Rappaport was their leader, and it was by far the worst season of Justified, but that's a Justified crossover of the week.
Justified crossover of the week.
That Oh, okay.
Kendall Crowe. He's pretty good in this.
He's got a small part. We're going to talk a lot about good actors with small parts. He really impressed me in Mud. That was his first thing, and I saw it at the time. And I was like, oh, this kid is good. He's gone places. And here he was 4 years later, and he was still playing. Actually, he was playing a much smaller role. He carried a lot of Mud. But in this movie, he carries a little bit of Mud, too, on the battlefield. Gets his uniform dirty in a sad way.
I didn't have him in the wrap-up of, like, let's see what the actors are up to, because he has a small part, but you inspired me to go check.
Oh, okay.
He's still working. He's actually going to be in Joker Folie à Deux. Whatever you think of the Joker films, they're certainly going to get a lot of eyeballs on him.
Good for him.
And he starred in The Sun, which I think was a Showtime show with Bryan Cranston. That was pretty good. Didn't get super far in it. No, I was wrong. It's Pierce Brosnan. Has nothing to do with the show I was talking about. I don't know what I was thinking of. He was in all 20 episodes of that show. So he's working, but he's 27 now.
Oh, wow. Man, time flies.
That's crazy.
You want to feel old? This is the kid from Mud.
Man, they sure liked giving stuff weird names in that movie.
Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey plays Mud. Jacob Laughlin plays Neckbone.
And now we got a Newt Knight.
Newt Knight. But yeah, so he's his nephew, right? Yeah, he's his nephew, Daniel. He's a pretty shit soldier. He just stands up in a trench.
He's like, snipers, look out. And he stands up, what?
Oh, they don't even have the decency to shoot him in the head. They shoot him in the heart or like near it. Yeah, he dies slow.
He dies real slowly. It's real dramatic and painful. And I guess that's the first point where McConaughey gets to really deliver his acting chops. This kid who we just found out he has a nephew literally 90 seconds before. And now the kid is shot and dying. And Newt Knight is pretty broken up about it. And it's very effective. Like, it starts a pattern that I really liked about this movie is like, this is what McConaughey's good at. It's basic acting stuff, but his ability to emote on screen and make you feel the feelings that he's acting, it's really top quality stuff.
Yeah, this was right around, I think this was around the True Detective time. No, this came a few years later, but he was really dialing into these men who were filled with a quiet kind of rage at this point. And he plays Newt Knight as a man who's like one more bad thing away from happening to just losing it all and going absolutely bananas. You see it boiling under the surface a lot, which is not an easy thing to convey in acting. So I really did like his performance in this movie. Whatever you think of how the character's written, he fucking crushes it. But I did want to touch on the steps the movie takes to make sure we don't think he's a coward for deserting. Not like anyone, John Carter could have taken a page from their book and just had him desert the Confederate Army. That would have made us endear him to, like, no one's going to hate him for deserting the Confederate Army or nobody I care to associate with anyway. But I was not expecting the level of violence on display in these early scenes of the Civil War.
Yes.
Not even necessarily violence, just like the grotesque aftermath of violence. Like, a guy's face is fully blown off, probably by a cannonball, I assume. And there's just like flies flying in and out of it. There's a bunch of pigs just eating corpses on a battlefield, like not a fresh battlefield either. Like, these guys have been dead for a while. And the movie is just like showing us, like, look, this is a stupid, pointless war. It was still just as horrific as any war fought for a good reason.
And not to mention, the guy's a combat medic. So his job is just trying to help people that are brutally, graphically wounded, running around. Everyone's screaming and crying. He's going into the medical tent. And it's a really good way to sketch the portrait of this guy, like who he is. I mean, it's basically a save the cat scene, as they say. The first scene is just show where he is, show who this guy is, and then give him something special to do that endears us to him. And he's on his little stretcher. He's got this private who's wounded. And he's like, you know what? When we go inside the tent, you're going to be a captain. In order to get this kid treated, what does he do? Does he switch out his uniform at all? Or does he just go, I've got a captain here? And then
I think just the hat, maybe gives him a different hat.
So it's cool. Like, now I know what I need to know about Newt. He's horrified by the injustice here, and he's willing to take risks and take dramatic, bold action to make things right.
Well said. We also get our first appearance of Serena Knight in this section, played by a great actor, Kerry Russell, who
fantastic.
Just doesn't get a ton to do.
No, this might be one of the areas where Ross actually had to cut some stuff back. She feels so thin and she disappears so fast without having said 10 words. Like, really, you're doing that to Kerry Russell? She's leaving the movie now and she's not coming back until the end?
Yeah, she disappears for an hour and a half, I think.
She does.
Which is far too long to be without Kerry Russell. I had just finished watching her be an absolute badass for 75 episodes of The Americans as Elizabeth Jennings. And here she's just kind of like, take our farm, Newt. He's like, oh, I gotta go. He just runs away. All right, that's it.
Like you said, as McConaughey does too, she does a lot of smoldering, right? So thankfully they've got an actress with her kind of talent so that even without many lines, you can see a lot of pain, a lot of difficult decisions on her face. And she makes this really difficult decision in her one scene where she gets to say a bunch of words. She tells her husband, she's like, you're always like this. You're always putting other people ahead of you and fucking things up for us. And it's like they're setting up an actual breakup subplot for them. But instead of showing that on screen where it plays out, she's like, I can't be in this marriage anymore, which maybe people didn't say in 1860, but they just show her. She looks at a poster. She sees that her husband is wanted for treason. And the next shot, she's packing a wagon and like, oh, Serena left town.
To be 1,000% honest, I wasn't aware that they were like a married couple the first first watch. I was like, oh, like that must be like his like sister-in-law, maybe. Because like, it's not like they embraced when they first saw each other and kissed. Just like, baby's got fever.
Like, that's true. That's true. You couldn't tell. The movie is a little tricky just technically to absorb what's going on, because the first woman he does come back to is his sister, right? He's bringing his sister's dead son back. So that's the first woman we see. And then it's the South in the middle of the Civil War. So all the dudes are gone. So every household, you go into a different household and it's just another woman in a similar dress with some kids. And you're like, how am I supposed to know who's who? And I don't blame you.
Yeah, it is a little confusing. And you are going to get a lot of my Southern accent on this episode. So just prepare
that's
yourself.
That's great. I'm ready.
Baby's hot. All right, Carrie Russell. You can go home now for 9 months. We'll call you back. No, it's like she shows up 8 years later in the film's timeline.
Yeah. And the hot baby is really kind of...
Don't say the hot baby.
The baby being hot, if you think like that was her achievement in like story that she was communicating, that could also just be seen as a hook, because we needed to introduce Rachel, the Gugu Mbatha-Raw character, who comes to treat the feverish child. So it's almost like Carrie Russell's just doing grunt work to...
She's technically matchmaking, really.
It's true.
She ends up being... Like, I assume they didn't get a legal divorce, so you can't get double married, Newt, even if you're famous.
There's actually a lot of interesting commentary on those relationships, on marriages and separations, except they don't make it. They just show that they happen, and you go, oh, why didn't they get a divorce? Well, probably because that wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
Why didn't he marry Rachel? Because he legally couldn't. So like, his love relationships are murky for reasons, but for reasons that they don't even try to talk about.
The movie's telling a story that has a romance on its center, but it doesn't seem interested in telling a romantic story, if that makes sense.
That's another thing that maybe there was a little bit more of that edited out, because they do have some slow, leisurely scenes in the second act, which we'll get to, where they form this relationship and it's based on interesting exchanges between the two. But overall, I would say not as bad as Carrie Russell, but Gugu Mbatha-Raw is also kind of shortchanged, underwritten in the script. She's good, so you don't feel like, oh, that wasn't any good, but like, she has certain chapters that she has to get onto the screen, but she's never really centered and she just feels a little thin.
There are moments where I wanted her to just beat Newt over the head with a cast iron skillet because he's being so fucking obtuse, but that comes later. I'll talk about it at the right time.
Okay. All right.
The escalating incident in this first act is when Newt rallies this homestead to defend themselves against the tax collectors in a pretty fun scene. This is where I definitely saw shades of The Patriot, which Matt was saying, which is not a good, like, you don't want to be compared to The Patriot because it's a bad movie.
Oh, okay.
But this is more artfully done and almost a little funny at times, just like watching our fucking Sheriff of Nottingham character, like, oh Lord, the ladies have guns. But he eventually, like, you know, gets scared and runs away. And it's like a rare feel good moment.
It was good. And I'm totally with you on Matt's Patriot comparison. Although I was going to go for another Mel Gibson reference with Braveheart, that like in this first half, it's a we're fighting for our land or we're fighting for our homes kind of movie. And those are good. And this is the scene where it like starts to come to a head, where he's like, I guess I'm going to do this. I'm going to teach little girls how to stand off a platoon of Confederate cavalry in order to protect their pigs from getting looted.
Last I checked, the gun don't care who's shooting it or whatever he says.
Yeah.
Cool line.
He's good. You kind of almost needed a guy of McConaughey quality to pull off that scene, which is kind of farcical, like you said, and partly humorous on purpose, and partly it's like a little too outlandish for a very serious history movie, because like he points to the other rifle barrels pointing at him from the barn, and they're clearly just broom handles, and it's like,
dumb is this fucking lieutenant?
Yeah, does the lieutenant believe that, or is this cartoon rules? Like, it stretches it just a little bit, but
I expected to see like the Joker's revolver from 89 Batman sticking out the window with a little bang flag.
Because of the lieutenant and because of McConaughey, and because it's just overall like a cute, funny, dramatic scene as well, it works and we excuse it and go, okay, that happened, I get it.
The scene never feels that dangerous or the stakes are super high, but then it is the point of no return. Like you said in our notes, Newt can't go home now. He's openly rebelled against a lieutenant and he's a deserter, which I was always like curious, like, how do they know? You don't know what anyone looks like back then. There's no pictures. Just lie.
That's true. But is it, maybe it's a small town thing where it's like everybody knows everybody, so that everyone knows exactly whose husband went off to war.
Yeah, it could be. It's just funny. Like, that's that deserter, Newt Knight. I saw a drawing of him once. That's got to be him.
Because these guys do seem like pretty local, right? Like, you wouldn't get left in charge of some county way behind the front line if you like didn't kind of come from there.
I wonder, because he never says any of the women's names when they're all like arguing with him, like, I need that cloth. And he's like, ma'am, this is going to the troops. If they knew each other, they'd be like, Mrs. Whatever, I do declare we need this.
They didn't play that angle. Yeah, that would be an interesting extra twist of the drama. If he was the local who was like on the wrong side of the issue compared to everybody else in town, that would be more interesting. interesting because it'd be more personal drama, but they left him as that Foghorn Leghorn character, which was fun enough for this movie.
Yeah, he's probably my favorite character, if I'm being honest. Like every time he's on screen, I just, because no one like is nice to him. His superior officer is kind of like, thinks he's an idiot.
Oh, that's true. He's shitty to him too.
You know, like he's just like a punching bag in a very weird little cape. And I love him. I don't love, like, he's obviously an abhorrent person, but you know what? I will say he doesn't take like pleasure in his work. It doesn't appear. I feel like you're supposed to think he's,
yeah,
he's more of a lackey of the colonel, but like when he has to burn the farms or whatever later on, like he looks distraught about it. They do like cut to him, his face. He's not like smiling. He's not doing the Jason Patrick right. in the, is that Jason Patrick in the Patriot?
Oh, okay. I don't know.
Oh no, the Jason Isaacs in the Patriot. Like okay. He's cartoonishly evil as like a similar character who's they're going to bring the hammer down on this town. You send this guy, but he like, he just locks everyone in a church and burns them alive and is like laughing about it. That's not this okay. guy.
No, he's this guy's like, just a,
he's following orders.
Exactly.
Which is evil in its own way.
Yeah. He's willing to very strongly enforce those orders, but he's just a little bit pathetic and not really evil.
I do declare. All right. Should I walk us through the second section?
Yeah. Let's hear what happened next.
Baby's got a fever note. I can't stop. It's going to be a problem. Baby's hot.
You're cracking yourself up.
I don't know why. In the swamp, Newt is met by Rachel, who guides him to an enclave of men who have escaped enslavement and are hiding out. There he meets a man named Moses, played by Mahershala Ali, who befriends him and tends to his wounds. Newt bonds with the man and launches a plan to remove the iron collar from Moses' neck. And then together they kill the manhunters and dogs who come into the swamp searching for them. Seeing that her husband is now wanted for treason, Serena Knight packs up and moves out of state. Meanwhile, Newt's relationship with Rachel grows as he teaches her to read. Then as the tide of the war turns against the South, more Confederate soldiers desert, and many of Newt's white friends return home. Newt incorporates the new guys into his swamp enclave. Swampclave. Calling themselves the Free Men of Jones County, they form a growing insurgency, waylaying and retrieving seized assets from Lieutenant Barber and his men. The conflict escalates and some of the insurgents can't take the heat, so one man and three boys surrender to the army, who promptly hangs them all. In retaliation, the free men and women stage an ambush at the funeral, massacring the soldiers sent to watch them. Newt even kills the Confederate colonel with his bare hands. This, in turn, escalates things to full-blown war in the streets, and the free men are successful at driving the Confederate army out of Jones. Newt and Rachel celebrate by consummating their romantic relationship, but the Confederates send a massive force to retake the territory. Newt reaches out to General Sherman for help, but the Union won't help them either, so they're forced to retreat to the swamp. But first, Newt proclaims that they are now their own country, the Free State of Jones.
He did it. He said the title.
This is where he's talking about the tenets on which they will build this new country.
Uh-huh.
And it's as simple as that. And I swear, I thought he looked right at the camera when he said it. And I was like, that's so lame.
You told me to look at that. That would be the ultimate cheese ball. Like, and that's why we call ourselves the Free State of Jones. And then winks at us. But I couldn't detect it. I rewound and tried to see that part. I saw at some point, it did look like his eyes were flashing dangerously close to the lens.
That's got
to
be hard, right? You've done a little acting, right?
Oh, yeah, I couldn't. I mean, I've done so little acting that I was just totally stymied by that part. I could never, like, relax my attention off the camera.
I would just stare at it. No matter where I am, my eyes would always be on it.
Also, I like cameras. Like, I just want to check out, look at that cool lens on there. What is that? But McConaughey's a pro. He shouldn't get caught doing that. The lens is down amongst the people he's talking to, so it doesn't look totally weird that he's, you know, looking our way.
It's a good speech. It's not super rah-rah. His blood never really gets up. He's pretty measured.
To contrast Matt's point, he does not go Mel Gibson with it and start screaming with his veins popping out of his neck.
Yeah, in real life either.
That's right. That guy just loves to pop them neck veins. But no, McConaughey dials it down, actually to a point where it's noticeable. It's not just, oh, this is just a middle-of-the-road speech. This is the point where the main character riles up his entire community and declares them a new country. It's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Quit the country that you're part of and make a new one. And he's so fucking chill. It's like, this Newton Knight is fucking, he's a dude.
I'd be like straining to listen. Like, did he say new country?
Speak up, dude. What are you doing with us here?
We need details. Yeah, this section is probably the most feel-good section of the movie because, except for the point where a bunch of kids get hanged.
That's true.
Ups and downs, ebbs and flows. But because most of this section is just Newt and the gang getting the upper hand on the Confederate army. Like, they don't lose a battle. They're never outmatched.
That's true. They do a lot of winning. It's only divided that we fall, I guess, is the lesson. Because when they're working together, they keep winning until those few guys decide, we can't take it.
Even after that, though, because the funeral is like a big turning point, too, which was, by the way, just a cool scene.
Yeah.
A bunch of ladies, like just shooting a dude in the head point blank. Cool kill.
That was like gangster movie shit. To actually pull an ambush where dudes pop out of coffins with shotguns and women dress all in black as 1860s mourners, whips out a pistol and point blank shoots a guy in the head. It's fucking pretty cool.
It's a fun scene. Fun? It's a cool, I don't know how to talk about this movie.
Yeah, it's tough.
It's tough. It's a very educational scene. No, it is fun.
It's powerful.
You're watching a bunch of racist dickheads get shot in the head.
And like you said, the movie makes sure to justify all the violent action that people take. So like seeing the fucking three boys who were scared and wanted to leave the group surrender and then get hung from a tree is pretty fucking awful. So you're like, okay, now they can do whatever the fuck they want. And Newt does. Speaking of veins popping out of the neck, this is the one point where McConaughey does some vein popping. He goes into this church where the colonel who's been shot runs away to hide among the church pews.
He's shot in the foot, which looks like pretty brutal.
Yeah, he gets shot like in the shoulder and the foot, and he's really suffering, which is good. You already hate the colonel by that time. He goes into the church, and the movie pulls a fun little, just a very small twist on the expectations. You see Newt confront him, and he's got his pistol, and he's pointing it down at the guy who's hiding between the pews, and he shoots the pistol into the wood next to the guy to scare the shit out of him.
A couple times, yeah.
Two or three shots until he empties his gun, and then he's like, gun's empty. I guess it's time to take off my belt. He kills him with his belt, right?
He strangles him with his belt and then drags him outside. Right after the guy's like, I knew your daddy. He's like, oh, you don't talk about my daddy. And he takes the belt off and just fucking...
He strangles the man in the pew, and it's just like, that was like a really violent and intense close-up on McConaughey with the colonel's head showing in the bottom of the screen as his life was being choked out of him. I was like, that was cool. That was a great way to cap off that scene with some serious revenge action.
Yeah, and it's a nice counterpoint to that measured performance we're talking about. It's one of the scenes that gave me this hypothesis of Hayes trying to play him as a guy who's just keeping it together, barely, and can go off the handle at any moment. Like that was an example of him losing his composure, but not really, because like he still executed his plan to perfection. It's not like his temper got the better of him.
It didn't get the better of him, but it shows you, I think your theory is great. He's really aware that he lets his temper out one time in the movie, and he does it when he's alone in the church with a guy who he's killing. So no one else saw it. Nobody saw how the colonel died except him.
Right.
So he kept it.
I mean, they could hypothesize when he drags him outside with the rope
by the neck with a belt around the neck. Yeah. They had theories. There was theories.
Also, he probably wanted him to die like the boys hung or strangled.
Oh, that's true.
At least,
yeah. You know? I didn't think of that. No, that's exactly right. He wanted him to get the same eye for an eye.
I will say, I wasn't so upset that one old guy got hung because he was a dickhead.
He sucked. Hang that guy.
He was racist.
Spare the children.
He was the one who kind of he strong-armed the boys into leaving, I think. A little bit.
You're right. This movie does a lot of set, like as far as the moral justification to make everybody feel okay about every act of violence that happens. Yeah, they sabotaged the dude. They made him the racist guy who says shit to Mahershala Ali's character, right?
Yeah, when they're eating the pigs they stole, they have like the big barbecue.
Tells him no meat for you.
A lot of the N-word is thrown around freely in this movie.
It is.
Even by Newt, which I was surprised the movie did that. I thought that was, like, he never uses it in a disparaging way.
No.
He never calls anyone the N-word in an insulting way, but he does throw the word around quite a bit.
Yeah, the N-word gets used in a repeated catchphrase of the movie or like a linguistic theme of the movie. And so like you couldn't avoid saying it.
Right. It certainly doesn't take any pleasure in saying the word as far as I could tell, but he says it more often to show solidarity than anything else. If they are, so am I type of deal.
Right.
But it still was a little jarring, but we were getting ahead of ourselves because we meet Moses in this section too. And I wanted to talk a little bit about our introduction to Moses because he's wearing quite a notable punishment that I wasn't fully familiar with until I saw this movie.
Me either. This is the good part where if you are interested in historical stuff and you're willing to learn, you can learn some striking and disturbing stuff. Apparently this kind of iron punishment collar was not uncommon. It was well known because he plays an enslaved man who had tried to escape more than once. And when he was caught, it put this thing on you so that, first of all, you can no longer move around very freely. You can't possibly walk amongst trees or bushes without getting your head grabbed and spun around. And your life is just shit. You can't sleep. It's horrific torture.
It might not look so bad at first glance until you imagine wearing it every day for months, years. It's absolutely torture. They even remark upon it. He's like, yeah, I got used to sleeping with it on, but they're scared to remove it because they think the noise will bring the slave hunters. But Akane's like, well, what if we plan for that? Kill two birds with one stone. We'll get the thing off and we'll ambush a bunch of dickheads. And that's what they do. And it works.
Yeah, very successful. Like you said, what they show is Newt Knight is good at teaching people how to shoot other people when it's necessary.
Yeah.
Because this group of guys is like, we got it. Let's do this. And they don't even try to show that part on screen. They show the firing of the guns and then it cuts away. You're like, oh, I guess they killed every one of those dogs and man that was hunting them pretty neatly.
Yep. This might be controversial. How hard do you think it would be to beat a bunch of Confederate soldiers using guerrilla warfare tactics because they're just like walking in a horizontal line. They're playing the drums, like their heart's not in the fight. There's probably a flute. There's a flautist amongst them announcing their arrival.
We've discussed this. Yes. The need for flautists and drummers was apparent in Napoleon. Those guys got shot to shit. Yeah. I think it wouldn't be that hard for any of those traditionally regimented infantry. But actually, in that sense, the Manhunter type of guys that they were killing in that scene are some of their more dangerous opponents, right? They're actually experts at navigating the swamps. They've got dogs. That was a tough one that came through.
Yeah. Wish we would have seen more of that little fight because would have been, I guess we didn't need another scene of Newt and the gang murdering a bunch of people.
This movie didn't have time to be all the things that it wanted to be. It's super long and still a lot of these things feel shortchanged. Like in this section, as we mentioned, it gets to the swamp and certain things slow down. It spends a lot of time just Newt getting to know and bond with and understand Moses and the other escaped enslaved men that are hanging out in the forest. There's like a bunch of time spent with that. Rachel makes a couple visits. There's little scenes dedicated to their relationship developing. There's the insurgency developing and all of that. The movie never feels hurried, right? It always feels very sedate, flowing smoothly. Not stagnant, but it takes its time.
Not boring either. Yeah. I never felt bored, but it's an interesting approach. War movies can be numbing with just constant battle scenes. And sometimes it's what they're going for because shell shock is a real effect of being at war. And maybe they're trying to imbue some of that in the viewer. But here it's showing all the other stuff that happens in between, which is a novel approach.
And the amount of that it puts on screen in its measured way in the second act made me convinced that I could see the boundaries of the story, right? It's about an insurgency. He comes back home. It builds up. He adds some of his white friends and becomes bigger. It has this setback with the kids hanged. You can see it. And then, oh my gosh, it must end with a climactic battle. And they declare the Free State of Jones. That's not the end of the movie. That's the end of the second act. And then a whole other thing starts. I was surprised.
Do you want to tell us about that other thing?
Sure. All right.
There you go. Look at that segue.
That was good. The Civil War ends, and suddenly the people of the Free State of Jones are now truly free, including those who were formerly enslaved. But just as quickly, the Reconstruction of the South falls apart. The wealthy plantation owners are restored to their wealth and power. The KKK is born, and African-American people are again subjugated. One day, Serena Knight returns to town with Newt's young son in tow. And despite the fact that Newton is now partnered with Rachel, who is pregnant with his baby, Newt welcomes his ex-wife and son to live in their house as a blended family. Later, when Moses' young son is conscripted to work on a plantation, Newt helps Moses bring the boy back home. Then Moses becomes a leader of the local Union League, a group that registers freedmen to vote. But the Klan assassinates him for it. With Moses gone, Newt and his two closest white friends step in on election day to face down armed intimidation and make sure a group of local black men are allowed to cast their ballots. Rachel then tries to convince Newt to move to the North so that their child can grow up and escape the repression of the South. But Newt refuses to leave the land he calls home. And now we jump 85 years later to 1947 and see how the consequences are still in effect. A court rules that a man named Davis Knight is the great-grandson of Newt and Rachel, and therefore, under Mississippi law, he's black, and his marriage to his wife, who is white, is illegal. Like his stubborn ancestor, Davis Knight refuses to leave his home state or to renounce the woman he loves.
We got nowhere to go, Newt.
Who said that?
That's Serena.
Oh, okay.
We ain't got nowhere else to go.
Your whole accent is based on Serena. All your quotes are about hot babies and going places.
Don't say my quotes are about hot babies. Feverish babies.
Feverish babies.
No, you forgot the lieutenant.
Oh, the lieutenant. Those are your characters.
These fine ladies are going to shoot me for collecting my tithe. Tithe?
I think
it's tithe. Yeah. Civil War's over. Happy ending. We can all go home now. Wrong.
They rub it in your face. Just how quick it falls apart is staggering. Yeah, I guess you never know exactly how quick things are going in this movie because the years will tick off on you when you're not looking.
I guess you can track the amount of time by the growth of the hot baby.
Yes.
He's like, what do you think, like 10 when he shows up there?
He's old enough that Newton can give him his pocket knife as a gift when he's reunited with his son.
And they have a very heartfelt reunion where he goes, you know, I'm your pa, right? He goes, yeah. He goes, aren't. And then they're just like.
I love that. I actually thought that felt real and cool.
Is Newton Knight a deadbeat dad? We got to get into it.
He definitely wanted to escape those allegations because as soon as he saw her, he's like, you guys come on in. We're going to look after you.
Did not go discuss it with Rachel first, I noticed.
No. She's stepping out the door as he's promising, but it's too late. He already said, but you can definitely stay here. And then she's like, yeah, of course, you can definitely stay here.
Yeah, she's like, we got a shed out back.
Sure. She does suggest a shed for them.
Which, if you see their house, like, it's not big. So
it's not much bigger than a shed. bed itself.
Yeah. Getting some gray in his beard so we know time has passed.
That's true. There's a little gray fringe. I noticed that too. Good touch.
The scene where he goes to court to try to get Moses' son back, I think is actually the angriest we see Newt in the whole movie. When he's like, how much you want? You're buying and selling people? I think it's like $70 he gives them. And I was like, where the fuck did he get $70 from?
I don't know. Yeah, he's been more successful lately, I guess. And the judge is none other than the lieutenant in a judge outfit, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And he loses it too.
That doesn't seem like a conflict of interest.
He loses his cool Southern composure and he starts hammering his gavel on the table. And I just love that. That to me was fucking cool, badass drama.
Mr. Knight, I said.
He's banging away as Newton's yelling at the slave owner. It's good drama.
And that's the slave owner that was raping Rachel, right?
Yeah, the very same. Everybody's come up and says they're fucking justified multiple times over.
Small town.
So I think you're right. It's a very powerful scene. It's really well done. But it does highlight the fact that, again, hard to beat the white savior allegations. They develop the Moses character in this third act of the movie more than they give him time to do in the first and second, or in the second when he shows up. But still, it's always Newton is like, hey, I'm going to tag along and hey, I'm actually going to stand up for your kid in court. And it's understandable. It's because he can, because his father wasn't even given the right to speak in those kind of situations. So it's not like somebody made it wider than it had to be, but it's just, it reinforces this role for Newton Knight.
Well, they kind of did because Moses was not based on a real person. So you invented a black freed slave whose son is taken hostage or forced apprenticeship, whatever.
Same.
And now Newt has to go save him. So look, you did kind of make up a guy to get mad at, to put it on the internet terms.
You made up a guy to get white saviory about.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a fair criticism of the movie, but it still makes good drama. It's still, if I'm to take the flip side of that argument, I learned things about history from this movie that I wouldn't have known if I hadn't seen it. So you can say, yeah, Ross was working the system in order to tell the story that he wanted to tell, but, you know, doesn't totally absolve it of its criticisms.
I have a controversial, I keep saying that. I think I've said the word controversial more times in this episode than any other, but I have a controversial question.
Okay.
And I'm going to lay out the facts here. The movie would posit that Newt Knight, Rachel, and Serena all lived on the same farm till they died. Rachel died in 1899. Newt and Serena died within a year of each other, 1922 and 1923.
Whoa, okay.
For the 23 years that they were the only, you know, you think they got back together a little bit?
Oh, man. Shit.
It gets cold in those Mississippi nights.
Does it?
Literally the swamp.
That's the thing I was talking about earlier. The movie raises, accidentally or on purpose, some pretty interesting questions about their relationships, about these people and the way they related to one another. And it's not going to answer them. It's not going to even try. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know that fact. You did some extra paying attention to the dates and stuff to sort that out. But it's weird. They're a very modern family. Call ABC because this is your modern family back in 1865.
They were way ahead of the thruple or the polycule kind of popularity that is currently happening. Is it currently happening? I don't know. I think maybe I just have a weird TikTok algorithm. So let's rip the Band-Aid off and just talk about this fucking framing device that the movie has decided to insert.
Yeah.
What'd you think of this court case that we get? We do see it in the first act briefly, just enough to make us understand like what they're arguing. Is Davis Knight a black man? And does that make his marriage invalid in the state of Mississippi?
Right.
I'll be honest with you. I don't give a fuck. It stops the movie dead in its tracks. And also, I don't think Brian Lee Franklin's a very good actor. He's no McConaughey. They should have just had McConaughey shave his face and play his great-grandson.
That's the problem, yes. I don't really know Brian Lee Franklin, who played Davis Knight, but he gets a fair amount of screen time, especially in this third act. And like you said, we've just seen McConaughey put on a clinic about, like, this is how to be a movie star and how to establish this historical character with all these incredible human qualities of bravery and sense of justice and all this stuff. And then they cast this guy who looks like you would cast to be the dweeb, and he plays it kind of like he's dopey, right? Right? Like the way he responds in that chamber scene, the sidebar with the prosecutor.
Proper union. I was married in this courthouse. See, I could do a third accent.
You found your third guy to complete your set. Yeah, it's weird. And even the prosecutor calls him out and goes, were you not listening the whole time? You didn't know we were challenging your marriage? And it's not supposed to be that he was a dummy and didn't know what he was doing in the courtroom, but it's supposed to be that he's so indignant that he's like...
Yeah, he's like grandstanding, but it doesn't come across that way.
But it doesn't come across, and he doesn't have any of the qualities that we just saw in Newton Knight. So it just seems like a casting failure to not find an actor that you could put on screen and go, oh, whoa, that guy is definitely Newton Knight's great-grandson because he's obviously a badass too. This guy is just a weirdo, a little dweeb.
Weirdly, he looks more like his nephew Daniel than Matthew McConaughey. Like they could be related. Also, when he tries to look serious and pensive, he gives himself the world's most unfortunate double chin for some reason. I don't know if you noticed that.
I didn't.
He's always kind of like jutting his neck out. And
I missed it.
It's a very strange affectation, but yeah, not a fan. fan of this storyline. Like, it's an interesting story for sure, and it's based on a real law that was in place, and I get all that. I'm not disputing its merits as a story to be told, but this movie's already a hat and a hat, and now we're just throwing a third hat on there. What are you, the lieutenant? How many fucking hats do you need?
Yeah.
Another hat, please, for my collection.
Actually, you know who had a cool, the colonel had a cool hat that like didn't even match his outfit.
Yeah, he doesn't wear it often enough.
No, he puts on in this one scene, and like, that's the wrong color, that's the wrong style, but it's weird and frilly, and that was the kind of hat I was willing for them to put on in the movie. This scene, I think you're right, this whole subplot, you see it unfolding and you're like, oh, I get it. I've seen this in other historical biopics have a flash forward framing device.
Yeah.
But then when they really lean into it, you're like, okay, but there wasn't enough movie before this.
It's also maybe a little less impactful because it's not fast forwarding to present day to show like how backwards it still is.
Yes.
Like, this is still history to us. It's just slightly more recent history.
That's true.
It's still almost 100 years ago. So it's not maybe making the point about things aren't any better that it might think it's making. I don't know if that's the point it's even trying to make.
Certainly making a point that things were still bad then, and we can reflect on how recently that was. Certainly a lot closer to us than the Civil War feels.
There's cars and stuff.
Hey, they're in a car. I've been in a car, and I haven't been on a horse or a wagon like everyone else was. But yeah, it's kind of a deflating way to end the movie. Like, you had a movie that was about war and injustice, and then it's like, let's go to a courtroom and watch a dweeb in a weird suit just go, I hate you guys. And that'll be our big ending. It's like, you kind of let some air out of the bag.
And then they're like, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. But then they were like, nah, never mind.
Exactly.
Like, they didn't want his conviction to be challenged by the federal government, who would like then maybe take a closer look at their state marriage laws, which maybe they should have done anyway. Like,
yeah.
You should be aware. Yeah. Was there anything else from this section we wanted to touch on?
I don't know. Did we give Mahershala Ali his due? He's super cool in this movie. I don't want to gloss over that.
He's Mahershala Ali. Yeah, he's great. He's great as Moses, a character who could have used more screen time, could have used a big hero moment perhaps, but the movie kind of does him dirty. You invent a guy and then you just kill him.
Kill him to make the white hero sad.
You also make the white hero go save his kid for him. I'm almost kind of realizing this now as I talk it through that like the movie did do Moses dirty.
Yeah.
Let's take a look at where Gary Ross went after this, huh? How's that sound?
Did he do anything else good?
Depends on what you think is good. He did make Ocean's 8, which is not bad.
Okay. I didn't see it.
I like it. It's fun. It's no Soderbergh Ocean's movie, but you know, it'll do. It's better than no Ocean's. No Ocean's would be terrible. Where would you go swimming?
Be dry.
Yeah, so he made Ocean's 8, which was a modest hit, I want to say. I don't think it made like a ton of money, but it got him back in the green, or the black, rather. It's profitable black, right?
Yeah, I say in the green, too, because that's what my spreadsheets, I use green when we're profitable.
Yeah, if it pops up red, you're bad. If it pops up green, you're good. He was also one of the writers on a movie we've talked about a little bit, Rupert Wyatt, as Desert Warrior.
Oh.
We covered a Rupert Wyatt movie. I can't remember which one it was. Now, hold on. Captive State.
Oh, that was, okay. Okay, that connects it for me.
Yeah, so he directed Captive State. He's directing Desert Warrior, which is in post-production currently. And Gary Ross is one of the writers on it, so he's still writing. Let's see what the writer of this movie did. Oh, it was also Gary Ross.
Yeah, he has like a really impressive writing. Like starting out, like Big was his first.
The Hitchhiker was his first writing credit, but that's just a TV series.
Okay.
He wrote one episode of it called The Man of Her Dreams, which sounds garbage. Yeah, but Big was his first movie he wrote. And also he got a co-producer credit on it. But Matt did allude to the fact that his father is Arthur Ross, who was a well-known screenwriter. Wrote The Great Race, Creature from the Black Lagoon, San Quentin, Brubaker. And
wow.
Yeah, so Ross is a little bit of a nepo baby, but Arthur Ross was actually blacklisted during the Red Scare.
What a career. What a history.
Ross is staying on the good side of history. It's a badge of honor to be blacklisted during the Red Scare. Shouts to my boy Trumbo.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Mr. Baseball, a movie I liked. Couldn't tell you the first thing about it, except that Tom Selleck was in it.
Okay.
I don't even know if it's appropriate for children, but I definitely watched it a lot as a kid.
That never stopped you.
Dave, I never saw Dave. That's the Kevin Kline, Ivan Reitman movie. It was a box office success, was met with critical acclaim. All right, so he's on a roll here. And then Lassie, I remember the Lassie movie. I loved it because it's about a dog, cute dog. Uh-huh. But I think it was a flop. Oh, I love that Lassie is first billed Howard as Lassie. I love when people name their dogs like just a person's name.
Howard is a good one.
It's my dog, Greg. And then he moved right into directing with Pleasantville, which sucks, and Seabiscuit, which also sucks, but in a much more Oscar baity way. That's my opinion anyway. I know I'm not in the majority there, but I didn't like Seabiscuit that much.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent I criticized Free State of Jones for being like too much of preachy edutainment history lesson stuff, it's an engrossing, engaging drama, whereas I don't think I could force myself to watch 10 minutes of Seabiscuit. I'm sure they put some good story in it, but I'm like, that's just old dusty shit I don't want
to
see.
It is old dusty shit. That's the best way to describe it. They should cast Kerry Russell and be like, horse broke his leg.
That would liven the movie up.
Let's talk about the Mac Man.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Mac. He was on a bit of a streak. He did Magic Mike, Dallas Buyers Club, Wolf of Wall Street, and Interstellar. And then he's started a slump that he hasn't really snapped out of yet. He did those four movies, all of which were critical darlings, most of which I think were financial successes as well. The only one I'm not sure about making money was Dallas Buyers Club. The rest were big hits. And he worked with my boy Stevie, Magic Mike. But then he did The Sea of Trees, which sucks. Okay. Free State of Jones, Gold, which was a huge bomb. Dark Tower, which fucking sucks. Check that episode out.
Yeah.
White Boy Rick, which bombed hard. Serenity, which was a big bomb. And The Beach Bum, which sucks and was a bomb. And then he finally had a hit in 2019 with The Gentlemen, the Guy Ritchie movie.
Okay.
But that was his last live action movie role, as far as I know. He's been killing it as Buster in the Sing movies.
Oh, that's right. You're a big Sing fan.
Yeah, love Sing. He's a little koala. He's cute as a button.
Yeah, he rocks in that. You got me to try Sing, and I'm like, oh, this is awesome.
But he does have some movies in production. He's got The Rivals of Amzia King and The Lost Bus coming soon. And then he's going to lead another Yellowstone spinoff somehow.
Oh, okay. Which, mixed feelings on that.
Yeah, how many fucking Yellowstone shows do we need? But I think it's going to be the main Yellowstone show after Yellowstone ends, because Kevin Costner doesn't want to do it anymore.
Oh, okay. It's a good replacement if you want a crusty country guy to lead a show like that. Like, okay.
Gugu Mbatha-Raw. She hasn't had a huge career in movies. She was recently in the Kevin Hart crime comedy Lift, which looked okay. I didn't watch it. She's been very active on TV, though. She was in The Morning Show. She was great in season one of Morning Show as Hannah, one of the main characters, back when the show knew what it was trying to say and was not terrible, if you want to know my feelings on seasons two and three. She was on a show called Surfacing for a few years. She was on The Girl Before and Loki.
Oh, neat.
Stands to reason she'll see her way into the MCU film universe at some point if she's a big part of Loki.
Yeah.
Which it appears she is. Speaking of the MCU, Mahershala Ali. So this came out right before Moonlight and Hidden Figures, which kind of turned him into a leading man.
Yeah.
And then Green Book came out in 2018. And whatever your opinions on Green Book, it won a lot of awards and made some money, I think. Viggo Mortensen's Italian accent is something to behold.
I would have maybe otherwise eventually gotten around to that movie, but the discourse on it was like, this is weird, don't watch it, and I didn't.
Also a very white savory movie. Do you know the history of the Green Book, the place for that were safe for black people to go to if you're traveling around the country?
It's the same thing as in what's our sci-fi?
Lovecraft Country.
Lovecraft Country, yeah.
Yeah, so imagine you hear the Green Book and you know what that means, and it's like starring Viggo Mortensen. It's just like, yeah. Oh, come on.
Really turns the screw.
Viggo. He's also the voice of Uncle Aaron in the Spider-Verse movies.
Oh, yeah.
Which I somehow didn't even realize. He's got Wildwood in production right now, and he's still supposed to be Blade at some point.
Oh, yeah. I thought I saw an update on that recently, that like they're focusing in on him and that.
I think they can't lock in a script or a director. Like, it's perfect casting. I do hope it pans out, but I'm starting to wonder if he's going to just cut his losses at some point because they can't get this movie made.
I want to see him in the shades and the leather.
Also, an underrated Blade was Sticky Fingers. Did you know the rapper Sticky Fingers from Onyx played Blade on a TV show for a while?
I don't know any of what you just said.
They were one of my favorite rap groups growing up. He actually...
Oh, okay.
He has a very good solo album called Black Trash, and he was trying to transition into being an actor. I don't know how much it worked out for him, but he was Blade for a time, and he was not bad at it.
How long ago was that?
I'm looking it up right now. He was still acting as of 2022. He's been in stuff. 2024. Oh, he's still acting. When did the Blade show happen? Blade the series, 2006. Enough time has passed.
It's time to hand the torch.
Yeah, but he wasn't bad as it. It's worth checking out. And also, if you like East Coast rap, check out Black Trash,
okay.
The solo album by Sticky Fingers. He's quite a character. But yeah, I hope Mahershala gets to be Blade. That would be cool.
Can't wait.
Well, that is Free State of Jones. Should we let them know what we're covering next week?
Yeah.
I love that Ian texted me 20 minutes into this movie. He goes, hey, I know you said you like this movie. I'm trying my best, but I kind of hate it. Did you go any further?
No, I haven't gone any further. So let me assert that I am still unbiased about next week's movie. I have not watched enough of it to form a real opinion. Just a very cursory hatred bubbling in my guts.
So this is a true cult favorite. It's a movie that I don't think that many people know about, but hopefully we can convert some listeners into viewers. It's The Way of the Gun, which was a 2000s movie written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie, who came up, of course, because he had a role writing for The Mummy. And that kind of put this idea in my head. Stars Ryan Phillippe, kind of like the leading man who wasn't, like in the Josh Hartnett mold. Guy who could have been like a big star and it just never really panned out. But also it's got Benicio, our boy, Juliette Lewis, Nikki Catt, Taye Diggs. Good cast. I'm excited to check it out. I have not watched it in many years, but I was a big fan of it back in the day.
Cool.
I said the name, right?
Yeah, Way of the Gun. I'm hopeful.
You're about to say excited. You changed it at the last minute to hopeful.
I'm not excited because the excitement's already worn off, but I have high hopes for people like Christopher McQuarrie and Benicio del Toro and even Ryan Phillippe.
Yeah, I like Phillippe. He can be good and stuff.
Yeah.
That's the faintest praise I've ever given anyone.
He can be good and stuff.
He can be good and stuff. All right, well, thank you guys so much for listening. Please remember to rate, review, subscribe to the podcast if your platform of choice lets you do that. Reviews on iTunes and Spotify particularly are very helpful.
Yeah, give it a shot.
Actually, on Spotify, it's just a rating.
Oh, okay.
5 seconds.
That's nothing.
So we would appreciate it. You can follow us on Twitter at BlastZonePod. Email us, BlastZonePod@gmail.com. If you have any movie recommendations, feedback, just want to chat about movies, we're always happy to hear from you.
Yeah, love it.
And we'll see you next time in the Blast Zone.
See you next time in the Blast Zone. The Blast Zone.